of times, through the worst of times, through Nixon and through Bush. Do you remember 36? We went our separate ways. You fought for Stalin, I fought for freedom. You believe in authority, I believe in myself. I'm a Molotov cocktail, you're done pairing your baby. What's that confused look in your eyes? What I'm trying to say is that I burn down buildings while you sit on a shelf inside of them. You call the cops on the looters and pie throwers. They call it class war, I call it co-conspirators. 'Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw bricks through that Starbucks window, you left me all alone, all alone. You watched in awe at the red, white, and blue on the 4th of July. While those fireworks were exploding, I was burning, that swinging my black flag, hiding the peanuts that the party.
You are tuned in to the Circle Day Show on Resonance 104.4 FM. On this week's show, we have Simon Elmar, who's a housing campaigner and founding member of ASH, which stands for Architects for Social Housing. Welcome on the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Can you tell me about the group ASH, how and why you were formed, and what actions you've undertaken in your campaigns?
Yeah, ASH, it's been going for about a year now. It was set up initially by Geraldine Denning, who's the lead architect on it. And it now has it's kind of a working collective, depending on what projects we're working on. We have kind of up to about six, maybe 30 people have actually passed through it. It came out of Geraldine and I were very interested in what was going on in the public space in London. We were very aware that the kind of freedoms that we have in public spaces in London were being constrained and reduced. And when we started to try and find out why and do research on it, we realised it was linked to what was going on in housing in London. We particularly did a lot of research and some presentations around what was going on in Greenwich Peninsula. So this kind of led us into being more aware of what is going on in housing in London, the attack on social housing and council housing. And then we were kind of drawn into it by campaigns like the Focus E15 Mothers, and also by Class War as well, who were doing the Poor Doors protests for something like 20 months outside of one commercial road. So we were sort of knocking around trying to figure out how we could contribute, if you like, to what was being talked about as a housing movement. And we were contacted by some people on the housing movement to help with estates which were being threatened with regeneration, places like Cressingham Gardens Estate, Knights Walk Estate. So we started to get involved, and we thought what we could do is draw up alternative plans to demolition. We realised that the kind of arguments being used by council estate by councils, mostly Labour councils, to demolish these estates were false arguments. So we thought if we could make alternative plans, which came out of real arguments, we could try and save these estates. So far, we've managed to save Knights Walk Estate, about half of it. Originally, it was going to be completely demolished. We've worked with Cressingham. We're in the middle of a campaign with Central Hill Estate up in Crystal Palace, where we've made a proposal there. We also work with kind of finding information about local policy, housing policy by government and local councils. And we support campaigns by housing estate residents to save their estates by giving them information as well. So those are the kind of things that we've been involved in.
Social housing and council estate buildings are now embedded in the very fabric of Britain. How can you, but can you talk us through how social housing even came about?
That's a good question. I think the answer I'd like to give you is social housing came about through a struggle between the classes, particularly the working class and the ruling class. I'll give you some examples of that. It's a long history, but I'll give you a few drop-in examples. Probably the very first council housing ever built is the Boundary Estate at Arnold Circus, just at the north of Brick Lane. That was originally it was built in the 1890s. At the time, there was a notorious slum there, enormous overcrowding, incredible poverty, terrible conditions. And someone went in and wrote a report about it, and it got talked about in Parliament. And they came up with this idea of actually demolishing it and building real homes there for the people. Unfortunately, the homes they demolished, the ones they built in their place, were too expensive for the people who lived in the slum, which was called the Old Nickel, to actually live there. And the people who moved back in were skilled labourers from the community around there. And it's very interesting as a kind of a model of this sort of struggle between the classes, which is at the heart of social housing, that what was actually meant to be built as a way of housing people in dire poverty actually became a way to socially cleanse them from the area. Then I guess social housing was taken up again after the First World War, when you had this enormous return of predominantly working class soldiers, overwhelmingly working class soldiers from the trenches in France. Someone came up with this idea of homes for heroes. I guess up until then, the aristocracy, the ruling classes, if you like, had kept the working classes at bay. But when they fought in the trenches with them for 4 years, it's a bit harder, if you like, to continue to keep people in abject poverty and kind of treat them like animals. So they came up with this program of actually building homes. That was then pursued through the 1930s with the influx of modernism into architecture, which is an idea that, if you like, you can guide society for the better through the kind of housing that people live in. People then began to develop not simply individual homes, but housing estates. So it changed the way they thought about people could relate to each other, move in relation to each other, which was a move away from, if you like, just simply the terraced houses that the English had lived in for sort of hundreds of years. Then I guess the final bit is after the Second World War, when the Labour government took over, they started an enormous programme of house building, which was part of the development of the welfare state. And this supplied an enormous amount of homes. But originally when they built these were meant to be mixed communities. That is, there were people from all the classes mixed in together. Unfortunately, in the 1950s, when the Tories came back in, they changed that around and they started to build often very poorly made homes, which were specifically designed to take people from the working classes and also particularly people who were unemployed, people who had difficult social problems and so on and so forth. And they began to use them as ghettoization. So, and this is kind of going on today, this sort of thing. So social housing comes out of a struggle between the classes and in particular what to do with the working classes.
Wow. And David Cameron has pledged plans to bulldoze or overhaul what he deems as 100 brutalist estates across the UK. He said almost three quarters of people involved in the riots of 2011 in the UK came from these terrible council estates. What do you think are the underlying motivations for these plans, and do you think they are justified?
Well, they're an example of what I just said. David Cameron's, first of all, he draws a comparison between what he calls rioting and antisocial behaviour, poverty traps, these kind of stereotypes that he circulates around the estates, around council estates. As we know, the causes of rioting, in the case of the ones that he's talking about, the 2011, causes of that were social exclusion, aggressive and racist policing, and the murder of a black man on the estate. The actual estate he's talking about is the Broadwater Farm estate. It kind of shows how much out of touch, if you like, the Tories are, and David Cameron in particular. That estate has gone through a series of genuine regenerations. It's now regarded by residents as being one of the safest places to live in the borough. It's got the lowest level of rental arrears in the whole of Haringey Borough and the Haringey Council. It's deemed to be one of the safest urban areas in the whole of Europe. It's a very bad choice, if you like, because he's not up to it. But these are the kind of stereotypes that stick to council estates. As I said, council estates, architecture doesn't cause social problems. Poverty causes social problems, aggressive policing, the kind of attitudes that David Cameron embodies. The reasons behind this are, in this case, very clear. Nearby, there's an enormous regeneration project going on around Tottenham football ground. This has been taken up by property developers. They're about to build on the grounds of the old ground 585 luxury flats. They have zero affordable housing in them. To make way for the new ground that they're going to build there, they're going to demolish the Northumberland council estate, which has 1,400 homes on it. That's nearly 3,500 people, and the lovely estate with 300 homes as well. The motivation behind David Cameron's attack on so-called sink estates, which doesn't bear up to scrutiny at all, is the enormous amount of money that's being made in London through redevelopments of luxury flats.
And you co-wrote an article called Architects for Social Housing, Fighting a Political Crisis for Open Democracy UK. In it, you state, London's housing crisis is not a result of faceless economic forces. Mm-hmm. It has been carefully prepared and legislated over a number of years to serve the interests of those who benefit from it. I suppose, can you say more about this?
Yeah.
I do like what you're saying, by the way.
Faceless economic forces is that people say, you know, we can't hear, you know, we can't help it. You know, it's the narrative of austerity. Our hands are tied. We've got to pay back the national debt. You asked me before about social housing. The welfare state and the beginning of this enormous building in social housing after the Second World War. At the time, Britain was technically bankrupt. Our national debt was 245% of gross domestic product, more than three times what it is now. And at that time, we had the political will to build the NHS, to introduce national insurance, to start this enormous building program. So this kind of blaming on abstract economic forces beyond our control is one of the lies of austerity that has to be fought back. To give you, let me think, what's a good example of that? A development that one of the things that Ash was involved in, protesting against, was this development called Neo Bankside, which is a luxury development built on the South Bank. Through its fabrication and manipulation of viability assessments, it managed to reduce its affordable housing quota. It has to be built into any kind of new development, to something like 17%. It got reduced by nearly a half. when the building was actually built, it was the affordable housing quota, which by law it has to include, was actually built off-site. So it wasn't actually built in the building itself. And to build those affordable housing, the council, Southwark Council, actually demolished a day nursery and a child centre to build this housing on. This is a kind of a tactic which is used by a lot of very, very powerful property developers. They pay what are called payments in lieu, which are then paid to councils instead of them building affordable housing. I mean, when I say affordable housing, that itself is a misnomer, because affordable housing is now 80% of market rate. But even the social housing content of it as well is built off-site. The trouble with this is there's no land to build it on. So the money which is going from these property developers to councils is actually funding their demolition of existing social housing stock. This is the kind of economic structures, if you like, which are driving the enormous housing boom in London. Over the last 2 years, to give you an example, more figures, the property market in London, the property property wealth in London, in the UK, has increased by £400 billion. And to put that in context, the entire GDP of Finland is £182 billion. The property market in the UK is now an economy unto itself. It is bigger than the economies of many other countries, European countries as well. This is the motivation behind it. But I think the Tories in particular, although it's being driven, as I said, through Labour councils, they're also using this for political ends. As you know, Labour dominates the local government, local authority government of London. And I think the Tories want it back. They want revenge for 1945. So they're using the potential of this, the investment potential of the housing boom in London, on the one hand to make an enormous amount of money for an enormous amount of people. I should say a small amount of people. Mm. But they're also using it for political ends as well. They are socially cleansing London of Labour's traditional voters, the working classes.
Mm. And the Conservative government and the Labour Party are supposed to be the polar opposites in their political stances, but you've said that what they have in common is a neoliberal agenda when it comes to their policy making in regards to privatisation. Please expand.
I think anyone who works on the housing movement, who is involved in it, knows that. This, as you call it, what do you call it? The supposed opposition between the Conservative Party doesn't exist. In fact, as I just said, conservative housing policies being driven through Labour councils. One of the greatest threats to housing in London in particular, because of these high prices and the high value of land, are Labour estate, housing estate, council estate, regeneration schemes, would invariably mean the demolition of the homes and their replacement with luxury flats. Flats far more expensive, either to rent or to buy for the existing tenants. Give me an example. A few weeks ago, a few of us held a demonstration at a final report of the London Housing Commission. The London Housing Commission, these commissions are generally run by the heads of major housing associations and building companies like Peabody. In this case, it was also hosted by Savills estate agent. I've done a lot of research on this, I won't go into it, but the housing policy in London at the moment is being explicitly written by Savills estate agent. They're doing a lot of the financial auditing and the managing of the special purpose vehicles set up by councils, for instance, in the case of Lambeth Council, to manage estates. They are writing policy, housing policy for London, which is going direct to cabinet. And at this meeting, I won't go into any details, was both Sat Goldsmith and Sadiq Khan, the candidates for London Mayor from respectively the Conservative and the Labour Party. A couple of days later, Sadiq Khan released what he called his Manifesto for All Londoners, which is his campaign manifesto to become London Mayor. And in its housing policies, I went through it, and it had clearly been written by this London Land Commission. So in terms of the policy of the Labour Party, both from the leadership through the London Mayor and certainly down to its councils, there is absolutely or very, very little difference between the Tory Party and the Labour Party.
Thousands of people took to the streets in London recently to demonstrate against the government's housing and planning bill. Can you explain exactly what this bill means for us?
Yeah, what this bill means for us, if it goes through, and at the moment it's being debated in the Lords, where there is quite a lot of opposition to it, it means the end of social housing, the end of council housing, and eventually the end of housing associations in London. It's seeking to eradicate the very concept of social housing. Now, that sounds like a kind of a crazy claim, but I can assure you it's absolutely true. The Housing Bill is a very complex document. I think it runs to about 200 pages now. And I'm one of the poor people who's had to read through it all and kind of understand it. It does four things, basically. One of the things it does, it gets people out of their homes. It does this either by forcing people who are actually on very little above the minimum wage, which the Tories have designated as being high-value earners. For instance, in London, it's £40,000 for an entire household. So you've got two people earning £20,000, perhaps with two kids. They would now be forced to start paying market rents. That forces people out. The other thing it does is it ends succession to secure tenancies. That means, for instance, if a mother and her daughter have lived in their house, the daughter's grown up there her entire life, the mother dies, the daughter's maybe staying there to save up some money to get a new home herself, the daughter will not succeed to that house. She'll be kicked out of her own home that she's lived in her whole life. New tenancies which are given to people will no longer be secure tenancies. They'll be between 2 and 5 years for people going into it. So first of all, they want people out. Then they want to do one of two things. They either want to sell those council homes through the right to buy. They're going to extend this to housing associations. Now, to put that in context, of the right to buy, which was introduced by Margaret Thatcher in, I think, 1980, it's one of the key tacks of the Tory parties, 40% of those homes are now in the possession, not of the people who bought them, but of private landlords, large landlords, who are renting them out for more than they originally cost. So right to buy is not about giving people the chance to buy their homes. It gives the opportunity for private investors in homes to take them out of the public sphere and into the private sphere. The other thing they're going to do is, which is one of the most malicious things of all, is they're going to force, through the Secretary of State, they're going to force councils to sell any homes which they regard as being too valuable or being high value. The trouble is, the kind of distinctions they've drawn up for that, £350,000 for a one-bedroom home in London, £400,000 for a two-bedroom home, actually means that everything in central London and almost every, I would actually say everything in greater London, is going to be enforceably sold off. The average price of a home in central London at the moment, £970,000. In greater London, nearly £600,000. So basically, every bit of council, every council home in Greater London that is vacated under the plans they've got to get people out of the homes will be sold off. Mm. The bill does a lot of other things in that. The other thing it does, which is very important, is all new housing developments have a duty now to build what they call starter homes. These are starter homes which will actually start at £450,000. There's actually no cap on them at all. Any new housing development, no matter what councils may want to do, or housing associations or any developers, must contain, have an obligation to build these starter homes. These are going to be extraordinarily expensive homes. Zach Goldsmith himself said it's going to be very hard to build a home for £450,000 in Camden. Price of a home in Camden is actually, the average price of a home is £900,000. The final thing it does, which is the most complex, least understood and dangerous part of the bill, is it's changing to planning laws. They're going to bring in planning laws, which means, in very simple terms, councils are forced to bring forward a register of what's called brownfield land. And once it's been identified, any property developer who wants to build homes on that land will have an automatic right to do so. It's called planning permission in principle. This is dangerous enough. It doesn't go through, have to go through any of the kind of qualifications of whether this is good for the local community, et cetera, et cetera. Who are the people being pushed off this land? It's also going to be starting to be applied to council housing estates themselves. There is legislation and there is political rhetoric, which I've been tracking for some time, to recategorize existing council housing estates as brownfield land. So it's not good news, I'm afraid.
It's terrible.
That's why it's very, very important that we fight this tooth and nail to the very last.
Absolutely, even more than the poll tax. A few weeks ago, we did a show about the F Parade, which is anti-gentrification street party. What do you think about the media reaction of the F Parade, as yourself also was targeted by the media for taking part?
As we call it, the F Parade. It's set up, I'm not actually part of it, I'm not part of the organisation, but I was down there. I got there a bit late, actually, and I was a bit annoyed at the time because I thought it was going to be a parade through Shoreditch to kind of complain about the gentrification in there, about which I know very a lot. I used to go to Shoreditch in the old days when it was kind of a nice place, or an interesting place. But at the time, it had moved down Brick Lane, and it got focused around this attack on the cereal cafe in on Brick Lane, at the south end of Brick Lane. I think in the general festival, because it was a festival, someone threw some paint at the cereal cafe. Now, at the time, I kind of thought we had better targets, if you like, for our protests against the gentrification area than a kind of a cereal cafe. But I was wrong, because the next day, to my amazement, and I think a lot of the people who were there, this story literally went around the world. Strangely, I don't know why, because I was actually not at the cereal cafe. I was in a pub actually watching a rugby match, which is not very class war. I got calls from New Zealand, from Canada, from all around the world asking to know about this. And people the next day, the social media was full of like, oh, you idiots, why did you attack a cereal cafe? So many important things. I'm going to say two things about this, which are actually the statements of class war themselves. First of all, they spent, I think, 22 weeks protesting about the poor doors. This is these exclusionary, what's the word for them? Segregated entrances to one commercial road, which is this enormous, huge block where the poor, the people in the affordable housing going through a back street, so on. It's segregation, clear and simple. Social segregation. They protested at that for 22 weeks. Nobody was down there then. They did it on their own. There was some coverage of it, but nobody was down there supporting them. When they threw, I'm not sure who actually threw it, but when someone threw a paint bomb or whatever it was at a cereal cafe, the news went around the world. So as a propaganda tool to draw attention to what was actually going on there, it was actually extremely good action, if you like, when you call
effective.
It was very effective propaganda. And it drew attention to the fact that where this cafe was selling cereal bowls for £4 in each, what was going on in Tower Hamlets, the cuts to services, the gentrification area, the driving up of rent prices, the demolition of council housing, which was all part of the gentrification process, which the cereal cafe was emblematic and also instrumental. It wasn't just a symbol. That's part of how these areas get gentrified. A lot of kids in that, a lot of kids in Tower Hamlets, it's one of the poorest boroughs in the UK, probably struggling to live literally on £4 a day for the whole family. The people who complained should have saved their complaints for what was being done to those kids, not to a bunch of hipsters who had to rub some paint off their cafe.
Last week, there was a documentary about the demolition of the West Hendon estate, which was built in the 1960s to provide housing for families on low income. Their local council has deemed the estate grotty. The buildings are beyond repair, they say, and in partnership with private developers, the estate is being demolished to make way for a multi-million pound regeneration scheme, which will turn the area into a luxury housing development. The documentary shows that the government is setting a modern precedent, the rights of the poor and thriving community being ignored for the behalf of the rich. What do you make of the documentary?
Yeah, I thought the documentary was very, very good, actually. It managed to combine both the kind of emotional and personal effects of regeneration to members of the community, which they kind of followed. But it also managed to talk about a lot of the kind of the lies and deceptions, the kind of tactics employed by Barnet Council, which is actually a Tory council. What I was very struck by watching the show is that these tactics are exactly the same with the councils that we're working with, Lambeth Council, Southwark Council, Hackney Council, and so on. Not working with, working against, if you like, struggling with. They all seem to be reading off the same menu, the same...
Song sheet,
that's the word I'm looking for. We know that a lot of the times these regeneration projects are run not by councils, but by specialist regeneration teams, professionals, who go to council and tell them how to do it. So it's not surprising that these tactics are used over and over again. It was heartbreaking. It made a lot of people very angry. I actually know a number of the people who are involved in that campaign. It's a lesson, I think, that we have to learn. It showed that the kind of promises, the right to return, which is emblazoned on every regeneration project, that residents, both council tenants, secure council tenants, and leaseholders, people who are in their own homes, have a right to return. The trouble is, as we saw in that, the kind of money that was given to leaseholders who had often lived there their whole life and spent their entire life savings, people who had no chance, people because they were of a certain age, they had no chance of getting another mortgage. They were being offered 30, 40% of the homes that they were then expected to buy on the new estates. That's social cleansing. The secure tenants there got into a place where they weren't giving secure tenancies. They were being given homes which are actually up to a lesser standard than ones, often much smaller. And above all, the people who were on short tenancies were simply kicked out of the estates. To go back to my earlier example, there was a woman on the estate who had lived there her whole life, and she had quite recently, within the last few years, moved into her own home on the estate as a secure tenancy. And she found out there was a cut-off line, which meant that this woman who'd lived her entire life on this estate with kids was now only not an insecure tenant, and she was simply kicked off the estate, driven into temporary accommodation in terrible conditions, often a million miles away from her work, from her kids' schools. The kind of treatment, I think, of residents that documentary brought forward is a lesson that we all need to learn, and we have to show that we have to defend our homes to the very, very last.
Let me ask you...
Can I just say one more thing about that? Yes. The other thing about that is, I think that show, is it showed that we've got to stop asking the people who are trying to destroy our homes to give us the means to stop them doing so. That is the property developers, the councils, the politicians. There's too much requesting from these people to give us the means to stop them doing it. We have to find other ways of fighting back.
Think outside the box, perhaps?
Big side of the box.
Over the last couple of years, we've seen spontaneous community housing campaigns like the Focus E15 Mums campaign on the Carpenter estate, and also the tenants at the New Era estate. Are there any past campaigns or actions that stand out for you that you've learnt from and felt inspired from by?
Yeah, I guess there's very many of them. Class War is the kind of campaigns they've had on the poor doors, the ones that they're holding at the Jack the Ripper Museum, this incredibly misogynist campaign which they've been museum which they can campaign against. Another one I'll talk about, which had a big effect on me, was the Fight for the Aylesbury campaign, which began in January the 30th last year, and went for, I think, two or three months. After the March for the Homes, which was held on January 30th, a large number of people, I guess, led by squatters, went down to the Aylesbury estate in Southwark and occupied a large amount of it. Over the next few weeks, they were periodically attacked by Territorial Support Group police. Who went in with very violent tactics, but they were supported by the housing movement. And they kept on moving from block to block every time the courts gave them an injunction to move out. They set up an enormous campaign which drew attention to what has happened on the Aylesbury estate. This is a place where, at one point, a ballot was taken which was attended by 78% of the residents. That's 7,500 people, 78% of them turned up. And they voted for something like 76%, this huge number of people against demolition and for refurbishment. They drew attention, my attention, a lot of other people's attention, to what is actually going on there, the homes that are going to be built in their place, the way that people have been treated, have been kicked out of the estate. Jane Rendell, a professor who spoke at the CPO, the Compulsory Purchase Order Inquiry, dragged out some maps of where the people who have been evicted off the estate so far, there's still many thousands of people living there, where they've all ended up. The tenants, the council tenants, have been socially cleansed from not just the buildings, but from the area. Most of them are living now in the outer suburbs of London. The leaseholders have been knocked as far away as Manchester and Wales. It really became a great demonstration, which was brought attention to by this campaign, which lasted, I think it was about 2 months, of the Fight for the Aylesbury campaign, which continues. It really brought attention to the way that people are being treated who are being evicted under these regeneration processes.
Mm. Last night, the group Class War and other groups had a protest in solidarity with the tenants of Cressingham Gardens in Lambeth. A meeting was held by the local council on the fate of their estate. You also attended the demonstration. Tell me how you found it, and was there anything revealing about the procedure of the decision making, and what should people do in their communities that could be effective in a way to fight back against what appears to be, well, it is social cleansing agenda?
Mm. Last night was the cabinet meeting, Lambeth cabinet meeting, to announce their decision over the regeneration options on Cressingham Gardens estate. This is a campaign. The Save Cressingham Gardens campaign has been running for, I think, 3 or 4 years now. They have come up with alternatives to demolition. They produced a 350-page booklet, which has financial models of various different options and financial models by which they could pay to refurbish the estate, to maintain it, to actually add more buildings to it, more homes to it, without it being demolished. They've got architectural alternatives, very similar to the sort of stuff that we do. Ash actually worked with Cressingham Gardens a year ago and kind of developing some of the plans there. But it's now been taken over by some other architects. It's a very extensive and comprehensive alternative to demolition. It also points out the failings, particularly the financial failings, in the model put forward by Lambeth Council, which is to demolish the estate, the entire estate, all, 306 homes, for which they're going to build 23 new ones for rent. It's absolutely absurd. this was the condition, this was the kind of the situation. The cabinet were there to announce this decision. We all know what it was in advance. There are a lot of people there. There were a lot of residents, a lot of supporters of the campaign. There are members from Class War and also from the Revolutionary Communist Group who was there as well. And it was very well supported. We all knew the decision. I think the actual meeting itself was about particularly residents from many, very many backgrounds, a lot of people who are suffering disabilities, talking about the lack of provisions made for them in the council plans for where they're going to go, where they're going to be decanted to, how they're going to come back on. There were a lot of testimonies, very moving, very powerful testimonies there. It's very important to listen to these people who are just being really treated like rubbish. There was a lot of information from people like Galinda, who was one of the kind of key figures in the Save Cressingham campaign, talking about the failings and the flaws and the lies and deceptions in the financial model of Lambeth Council, which many people there called again and again for instigate a full review of the council's financial model because it simply doesn't add up. There were revelations that, for instance, this vehicle set up by Lambeth Council to become a property developer, to develop these estates, which is called Homes for Lambeth, is now being managed by Savills estate agents. And I think the most important thing, if you like, that came out of the evening was at the end of the meeting, at the end of that part of the meeting, when the cabinet was about to make their decision, the floor stood up and we proposed a motion to have a vote of no confidence in the cabinet, in Lambeth cabinet. This motion was taken to the floor and it was passed unanimously, as you might expect. Then a large chant went up of shame on you at what they were actually doing to this community. It was a very emotional meeting, a lot of anger in there, a lot of controlled anger though, a lot of commitment to actually continue fighting. At this point, the cabinet, we didn't realise at the moment, they actually passed the decision to demolish the estate. They did it themselves. And then they arrogantly walked out of the meeting. At that point, we stood up and we had another vote, having passed a vote of no confidence in them, to vote for the refurbishment of Cressingham Gardens estate and against its demolition. And that was also passed unanimously. I guess we are going to keep on fighting. This is very, very far from over. Cressingham Gardens is going to, as far as I know, do a right to transfer and actually take the homes out of the control of Lambeth Coal Council and into a housing association, which will be community-led and community-managed. These are the kind of things that council estates are increasingly looking at to get their homes back from being stolen away by these councils.
So the idea is to reclaim back our housing and make it into a co-op type of thing.
Yeah, but also to take control over your lives and your homes, which are being threatened by these people. This literally leads to people's deaths. There's a lot of vulnerable people, vulnerable either financially or physically, a lot of elderly people, a lot of people who are on council estates for very good reasons, that they can't afford market rates. People with families, people who've come from often abroad and are seeking solace and protection in this country. People who should not be kicked out of their estates. There's a lot of support for these people, and slowly, but I think it's happening more and more, people are realising they have to fight against what's happening to their homes.
Yes. Thank you so much for coming on. And what's the website, Ash's website, please?
Yeah, Ash's website is called architectsforsocialhousing.wordpress.co.uk, if not .com. There's a lot of articles about these issues on there if anyone wants to read them.
And there's a Facebook page too, maybe?
There's a Facebook page also called Ash_Architects for Social Housing. We've got nearly 900 people following us now. And the kind of events, the protests, the events that we organise, and a lot of information about the campaigns we're fighting and the kind of proposals we're making as alternatives to demolition, you can find about on that page.
Mm. Maybe we might actually have some kind of revolution. Who knows? Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. We've reached the end of our time. Thank you, Simon, for appearing on the Circle Day show. You've been listening to Resonance 104.4 FM with me, Yudette Gerrard. I'll be back next week with another topic. Till then, turn on, tune in, and kick off. Through the best of times, through the worst of times, through Nixon and through Bush. Do you remember 36? We went our separate ways. You fought for Stalin, I fought for freedom. You believe in authority, I believe in myself. I'm a Molotov cocktail, you're done pairing your baby. What's that confused look in your eyes? What I'm trying to say is that I burn down buildings while you sit on a shelf inside of them. You call the cops on the looters and pie throwers. They call it class war, I call it co-conspirators. Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw bricks through that Starbucks window, you left me all alone, all alone. You watched in awe at the red, white, and blue on the 4th of July. While those fireworks were exploding, I was burning, that swinging my black flag, hiding the peanuts that the parties have tossed you in the backseat of your father's new Ford. You believe in the ballot, you believe in reform, you have faith in the elephant and jackass. And to you, solidarity's a four-letter word, we're all hypocrites, but you're a patriot. You thought I was only joking when I screamed, kill Whitey, at the top of my lungs.
cops in their cars and the men in their suits. No, I won't take your hand and marry the state. Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw